in heaven is just a sin away, and the sin being the separation between your physical and non-physical, not as a morality kind of a situation, but just a aspect of separation.
Right. So if we talk about heaven, we're going to say earth, not hell, right?
If we talk about heaven, we're going to say what?
Earth, not hell.
As Ion would say, I'm the only hell my mother ever raised, or some crap like that. But only about earth and heaven, correct? No hell.
Yeah.
So that Oscar Wilde or Mark Twain? Is like, I go to heaven for the weather and the hell for the company?
Correct.
Yes, I've heard that. I don't know who said it, but Oscar, I've heard that.
One of the two, right?
Yeah. Yep.
American must have said it one way or another. Anyways, yeah. Let's see. I'll find out. But I've been trying to find that the Wyndham Lewis thing, like, quote, written down. I guess I'll just dictate it from when you say it in that video about Quadrophenia on YouTube, but, like, about his political spectrum. I can't find it anywhere.
I got it right here. I'll post it. You mean about where he's part fascist and all that?
Yeah.
Because okay, just a second.
I'm like,
are you looking at your computer? Do you have?
Yeah.
You can look at the chat line.
Yes, I have it here.
Okay, here goes. Here's the quote from 1929. Ginny, Sean says, "Wow, Ginny." They like that explanation. So there's Wyndham Lewis. Now, disregarding, if you can, whatever your political views may be. So he's asking you in this part of the book, it's actually a journal he put out in 1929 called The Enemy, Volume 3, page 70. He's saying, now, regardless of your political views, but then he says, here are mine, you know, just full disclosure. And then he would go on to not talking politically, but he says, and mine are partly communist and partly fascist, with a distinct streak of monarchism in my Marxism, but at bottom, anarchists with a healthy passion for order. You're not going to get a better description, more eloquent, precise description of your condition, what we live in today, than that in terms of politics. That's what everybody is. And you could say the communist is the TV body. The fascist is the chemical body. Monarchism in my Marxism, that would be the chip body. And anarchist with a healthy passion for order would be the astral body. So right. You're juggling the bodies there.
So I'm in relation, like, why I really want this is because I'm talking to this big-time, big-time. He's a very internationally well-known curator. Great friend of my dad. I would say he's my friend, too. And we've been talking ever since he told me to watch The Death of Stalin when I saw him at an opening a couple months back. And he's like, watch Death of Stalin because it is the death of Stalin. The death of Stalin. Of Stalin. Like, that was his description. I'm like, okay, sure.
Is that a movie?
Yeah, it's a movie that came out. Yeah.
A documentary or a metaphor?
No, it's a little bit metaphorical, and no, it's what is it called? Like historical fiction. It's a dramatization of the death of Stalin.
Stalin is in the play.
Yeah, well, at the beginning, he dies, and then it's dealing with that death and all of the... All right, so like... So I was like, why are you telling me to watch this? This must be some sort of crazy allegory for the way you see art movement. And so I was like, Stalin was the 20th century ideals of expressionism and constructivism, and then Molotov would be surrealism, futurism, and cubism, and then Khrushchev is modernism, and Malenkov is abstraction. It was my, like, basic, just, like, intuitive correlation. And he was like, interesting progression into art movements. I like your intuition because it isn't about nailing it. I'll respond from a social historical side when I have some time. And so he
Could you repeat that? I didn't get the last one. Malenkin, who's that?
Malenkov? Malenkov.
You talking about the anarchist? No, that's Mayakovsky.
Malenkov. I was going off of the characters that were in this movie. I think he was like he was a Soviet guy. Let's see.
Okay, so you're talking about the movie. So do the four again. Khrushchev's the modernist.
Yeah, this was just my like.
Let's hear it. Do it again.
Yeah, okay. Suffice to say that each individual could be art movement. Stalin was the 19th century ideals of expressionism, and perhaps constructivism? Question mark. Then in that case, Molotov, would he be surrealism, futurism, cubism, taken over by Khrushchev, who is modernism, and then Malenkov is abstraction? Is
abstraction, right. Well, what's the second one? Who's that?
Molotov.
Oh, Molotov cocktail?
Like Molotov the Russian.
Yeah, and what was that's cubism, surrealism?
Yeah, that was just my, like, very
I know, it's okay. It's just a pattern. You don't have to keep apologizing for it. It's a pattern. We like patterns.
Yeah. That was my proposal. And then I he gave me back, like, the basic, well, no, because all artists were fighting the establishment. The people who gathered around Stalin, as with Hitler, played into the reactionary game. And for culture, the role of culture in both regimes was to assert the absoluteness of tyranny. No nuance there, no room for other thoughts, let alone the nuances of expressions. Leopold Boltek, Polish-born in the USSR, now a Canadian and artist, did an exhibition called Working Man's Dead, Lives of Artists, using official Soviet photographs. In short, modernity to the young USSR was a means to an end. That's an excerpt of his, like, larger response.
Right.
And it's interesting because, we kept this going in terms of our conversation. And then I wrote this larger narrative called Art as War. And then my thing is, like, now I was like, I'll just read this quickly.
Okay.
Now in the context of art, I see a similar level. So it's like, I will say that my allegorical interpretation of the whole film was a macro concept. Perhaps it is easy to say that political derision is the paradigm of literal hostile idea takeover, one regime toppling the regime before, eliminating its intellectual identity and sway by literally killing it. Now in the context of art, I see a similar level of hostility as in political regimes over the 20th century. Art movements are an abstraction from literal violence. Art movements gain, and then like I said a bunch of stuff, and then I was like, art movements gain victory like Canada Day celebrates a victory for independence, persistence until the power establishment relents. And in hindsight, we honor those artists that pose the question repeatedly in obstinance until they finally receive the only answer they would accept. Rather the dogmatic
very
tenor
good.
Of the
very good.
Century.
But you see, you're leaving out the technological ground of each phase, and media evoke the type of art movement. You know, surrealism comes out of movie land, dreaming awake.
It gets kind of in there in my larger, so like art as war narrative.
Each new environment, each new technology, you know, eats the previous environment. There's the war.
Somewhere in there, this is a quote from what I wrote. Somewhere in there, Fluxus got bored or tired of fighting other art with art and boycotted art supply stores entirely. Instead, they pillaged their environments and littered everywhere visually and sonically to make everyone feel ugly and sort of uncomfortable with their surroundings. All to expose the cliche of all the bullshit artists around them who still use lame as fuck paint and canvas.
Okay, now listen to this. McLuhan's famous pattern is that every new technology turns the old technology into an art form. And that process is usually anticipated by Gutenbergian artists. So he said that Andy Warhol putting Marilyn Monroe on silkscreen and Elizabeth Taylor on silkscreen and Campbell suit cams. So these were hardware and software of the influent industrial abundance, the consumer society. But in the 60s, we're flipping into a producer society. So McLuhan said, no longer does the past environment become art form. He says the present environment becomes art form. And nobody ever says that, quoting McLuhan. They don't know that, and they don't know this really important point. The present environment becomes art form. So that's what Andy Warhol did. He made a room, called it the factory, and he'd sit there and let anybody do whatever they were doing, make little movies, make some music, talk, get mad at each other, take drugs. All that present activity in the community of the factory was the present, and that was the art form, because we'd move beyond something human there. You know, whatever the humans were doing, like Fluxus, just grabbed their ashtrays and their little dolls or whatever little stupid artifacts they found and claimed that's art. They were taking their present and turning it into art because there was no present anymore. That's what you got to realize. So there's different ways to understand how there was not a present anymore. So anything in the present, as it's unfolding, is the art form. So that's pretty advanced understanding of where we were in the 60s. And no one even knew McLuhan said that. So I say it right now.
Right on.
Go ahead.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because my part of this little diatribe, or whatever you want to call it, or my thoughts on art, is and then at the end of it, it's like, meanwhile, pop art brought in modern drone warfare. Forgetting original works or images because they were too costly and inefficient, and they evoke emotion, and that's weakness. Plus, the public's imagination is already in our grasp if we use their images, and they won't even know it until it's already happened. And at our low-level cost and efficiency, we can afford to play the psychological long game. Like a ship in the night, art will mean nothing soon enough.
So. That's very good, very good. Now, you see, you want to turn it into a science. And McLuhan presented the science, or he put everything in order, made a chart out of it almost. So you want to take what you just said and say, this was better said by McLuhan. He said the pop art reflects the fact that present is environment. The present is an art form. See, when you know McLuhan, you can take these improvised things by young developing minds and fit them into a framework for you. Fit them into my chart.
Cool. Yeah.
So then you have a figure ground awareness.
I'll do that. Absolutely. I will.
But, I'll keep modern artist drone warfare. Any kind of attacking of anybody is trying to assert your presence is more valuable than their present.
Yeah. But the attacks are not man-to-man in the case of pop art. That's why it's mechanized, right? Technology.
Right. It's the beginning of the Android meme, where the parts of the machinic, not the machine, but the machinic, are fighting among themselves. And a good introduction to that is Baudrillard writing about Warhol. He recognized Warhol was pretty avant-garde, whether Warhol understood it or not. And his understanding and translation of Warhol's work is very good. Leads up to what I'm saying.
Excellent. Yeah. How do you feel about Dante and his work with?
He's old fashioned.
Like,
he says art. He says art ended with Hegel. 200 years ago. He's thinking too much of Gutenbergian arts and sciences. No awareness of the industrial and
lowercase art. Right?
Yeah.
This whole thing about like capital A art and lowercase A art. I don't know.
Yeah, I did an interview back at Dialogue back in the 90s, and I talked about small A art and capital A art. I didn't know Dante had done that, but I'd come to the same description. I don't know if it's exactly the same as his meanings, but I started using that dialectic. I do it in this this long interview called Entertainment Sucks. And but Dante, these guys, they all fail to appreciate what McLuhan had done and resolved. And it's because they couldn't. They're living in New York City. They don't want to work in a lousy job, so they had to keep the art world going. Right. And the critical world, and writing books, and writing essays, and Art Forum, and Art America, Art in America, all this, and October Magazine, endless typing to keep the idea of the pre-McLuhan art happening.
Right. Pre-McLuhan art is just like the same art, but within a different definition, right? It's like McLuhan, pre-McLuhan art is just
ineffectual definitions. McLuhan defined it perfect.
The ground. He changed the
ground. Yes, he made it so everybody could enjoy art. Art being their present environment and all that went up in it, went into it. So it was just too democratic for the literate mind. Literate mind had to have a hierarchy. So they went to New York City and they got into one art movement versus another, or they became journalists. They just kept the information environment going. It was the only way to have an easy job and not work at a factory and not end up like China, where you know everybody's forced to be a nobody and work for the greater good, I guess.
Right.
You know, Western was too individualistic to deal with the software communism of the electronic world. It was literally software communist. That's why McLuhan said to the Bilderbergers, what are we fighting communists for? We in North America are the most communist people that ever lived in terms of our hardware and software services, which back then were relatively inexpensive. So there's not a situation that can't be explained by McLuhan and useful for everybody to know. It's a new Esperanto. And McLuhan talked about every topic under the sun, and he demonstrated his method. The only thing that goes past McLuhan is Ion. You could say Ion completes McLuhan, Zappa, and all the greats, you know? And that's now here in Dobbstown, the greatest artist alive today, me and Carolyn, are selling the art in many forms, including food.
Totally.
Yeah, nobody can do that. Hey, we got a guy here. Florida. Let's see who this person is.
Hello?
You've been on here before. Bramley.
Hey,
you haven't been on here in a while.
I know. I've been working, man. Been working.
At what?
I just moved in Jacksonville. I was living in Orange Park, but Just move, man. Paying rent, shit, you know. But
okay, you call that working? You, I said,
what do you mean? You call that?
Move?
I mean, what do you else do you call it? That's not a vacation. I mean, it's obviously some.
What
part,
were you,
some
what were you working at? What are you
I'm
working?
Working at a financial institution. I customer service for Visa and MasterCards.
Yeah, for the software communist economy.
You could call it communist. Are you a communist? Because I'm living in America. We're a capitalist society, but are you a communist?
No, we're not communists. We're not capitalist communists. Those are all industrial 19th century terms. The software communism is what everybody's engaged in, where we have electronic environments that are relatively cheap. Anybody can use them.
If you could afford the internet and you could afford a cell phone and if you could afford a credit card or a debit card, sure, it's relatively cheap, and you could call it communism. But not everyone.
And if you don't have that, you're on welfare, and you got a television set, so that's just as good.
Yeah, not even cable, maybe basic TV with an antenna.
And you can claim you're a Gutenbergian artist that you're not joining the mass hypnotism of the internet. You're staying one technology back, and that's your art form. You know, you can justify.
Well, the internet's been around since the 80s. But, you know, the 90s and 2000s.
No, but you just said it costs something. Let's take someone who can't afford, they're on welfare, got very low budget, can't afford the internet stuff, nothing like that, can't even afford a cell phone.
Let me take that back. People that don't have a computer still call in to get their cards activated. So I'm not going to pretend that people that don't have a computer or internet can't have a debit or credit card.
Right. They can have something. They can have something. Yeah. So everybody can share in the electronic communism at some point.
Even if they don't have a computer,
Right. And if they don't know what's going on, they just watch soap opera or soap this or that or some stupid TV shows. They can, if they were sophisticated enough, they'd say, well, I'm an anti-environment to all you fuckers, arguing on your McLuhan Facebook forum, or even talking to Bob here. This is a good old cheap medium. Phone in and talk.
I mean, telephone's been around since like the 20s, though.
Telephone?
Yeah.
Oh, 1890s, I'd say.
Well, yeah, I mean, the early 19th century.
Yeah, late 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, early 20th century.
See, you're living, if you're a functioning, well-adjusted citizen with a job dealing with software services, you've lose your memory of time categories like you just did, It's all a blur.
I was born in the late 20th century, so,
you don't remember
hard.
That.
I was born in the 90s, so it's kind of hard for me to relate to the early.
That's right. You don't know nothing about it.
Century.
Nothing. You know about Hitler and Stalin and.
I mean, I know that all that from history and reading history books and high school and television history channel.
The poor education in high school. You know about Babe Ruth. You know about maybe a great horse racer. You might know about Einstein, but you have no clue of the details. You don't know what struggles they went through.
I mean, obviously, if you go to the library and read books about them and do research, you learn more, but,
you're obviously, if you go to the library, you learn more. We don't want any obvious statements like that. That's too obvious. Yes, you go to the library, you obviously learn more. You can say something not so obvious.
Well, I mean, you're not going to get credit, or you're just going to inform yourself.
Yeah, that's useless, isn't it?
It's not useless. I mean, you definitely learn about the past, learn about people that were great in history.
Yeah, well, you begin to think there was a past. See, it's a distraction. It's an illusion.
You're saying that there wasn't a past? You're saying Christopher Columbus didn't discover the New World, that we didn't land on the moon?
I'm saying that he hasn't discovered the New World yet. As much as he hasn't discovered it or has discovered it. This is the Ion's point, that all actions have already been realized.
Well, before Christopher Columbus, no other European discovered America. So
In the Book of Revelation, you see the 911 scenario is in the Book of Revelation, according to Ion. That's because John of Patmos could see New York City. It existed as it is today, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, they call that Babylon.
No, New York City as it is. Babylon was another place. But the point is that you can't believe that. You can't visualize that New York City, as it is in the 21st century, was actually, calendar-wise, back there with the Romans. Nobody's going to believe that. But that's because you've been trained to think in a linear space continuum, space-time continuum, that's caused by reading. Reading created that sensory prejudice in you.
I mean, that's how we record our historical data before computers.
That's right. That's called a book.
I mean, how else are you supposed to record data? Are you supposed to remember it by your memory strictly?
Well, you would use your memory, but you wouldn't have to record a lot of data because there wouldn't be any. None was written down. You'd have a pretty relaxed mind. Anything that you required, you would remember it because you have good memories in oral cultures.
I highly doubt that. I mean, that's all speculation.
No, it isn't. Ion says, if I say it, it is.
And that sounds pretty, you sound pretty confident. How can you confirm this?
I don't have to validate it to anybody, but I'll make attempts to validate it to you, but I'm not going to expect total agreement or total convincing of you.
You have to validate to the public. You can't just assume everyone's going to believe you by hearsay.
No, nobody's validating anything to the public. They're going around being zombies and robots and doing their jobs. Nobody's sort of saying anything. Then they won't even dare talk about Trump. See, so maybe 50 years ago you had to validate yourself, but not today. You don't have to function on a human scale at all today.
So you're saying human beings don't exist today? Is that what you're saying? That we're just a bunch of androids?
Yep. Yeah, whatever you thought humans were, the images we have in our cultures from the past, they don't apply today. Because you got four bodies, plus the mystery body, right? You got that. If you want to paint a person, you got to show the four bodies. And it's very hard to visualize a chip body.
See, how do you define the chip?
I'm not talking to Bramley, the guy with the arms and legs. I'm talking to an energy vortex that has four or five structures, a chemical body structure, an astral structure, a TV structure, chip body structure, and a mystery body structure.
Okay, but that's technology. That's not part of your physical body. That's
oh, yes, it is.
Those are instruments. Those are instruments, like the telescope.
Yeah, your books, when you went to the library, conditioned you or in school to think there was a split between technology and nature. That's a mistake.
Well, that goes back to Rene Descartes, the mind-body problem.
Descartes. Yeah.
The French philosopher.
Well, no, it starts with him because he got nailed by books. So he started thinking about thinking. And he gets into a mind-body split, which is a natural reductionism from the effect of black and white print. He's a total knee-jerk conceptualizer under the hidden effect of print. So, yes, he was one of the first of the Gutenberg era.
Well, he also started modern science.
Well, we know what science was. Because you had a book and then someone else had the same book, they go, holy shit, you mean you can repeat the experience? I got a book and you got a book just like mine? Wow, I never seen that before. So this repetition of book experience, the repeat factor, became a law for defining reality. They make an experiment and they said, now look, I'll do it again. It'll same result. So they're all hypnotized by the repeat motif. Repeat, repeat, repeat. And we call that science for a few hundred years until
call that verification.
Yes.
Verifiable.
Hear that? Seeing is believing. Whereas we forgot about other kinds of believing. So when the electric age came in, we couldn't repeat anything. So they called the principle of uncertainty.
Yeah, that's in the quantum physics.
Yeah, the sub-visible world, which we had entered with the telegraph.
So where are we now, Bob?
I can explain.
So where are we now, Bob?
I can explain.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could assume so since you lived through that time period.
I lived through today.
No, I mean, you're a little, I mean, you grew up in the early 20th century.
Yes. And so I know that data. But I'm not limited to it. I can talk about today.
Well, obviously you wouldn't be alive if you weren't able to talk about today, wouldn't you?
No, but I talk about it clearly and more coherently than anybody else. Really? Put that out there. Challenge anybody. Talk about today better than me. Can't be done.
Well, I mean, you're competing with a lot of news outlets and a lot of journalists and a lot of...
Right. I think it's
a reporters.
I swallow them up with my huge view, my huge scale.
So what is your message then? What is your message?
Well, for you, start thinking differently than you have been trained by your job and your past. Basically, just keep studying me and what I say and learn that language.
I mean, I've been looking at your videos and stuff. I mean, I'm still trying to understand what you're trying to say. I mean, I understand you talk a lot about these figures of people that are dead. And, I mean, obviously I wasn't alive back then. I just look at their videos.
Are you talking about the videos that I did in the 90s with my T-shirt?
Yeah, all those videos. Yeah. I was trying to understand. You were talking about the Bootians and aliens. I'm like, what? Okay, who are these aliens? How do you know these aliens exist? Can you
prove
that?
I got it
the
from
Evergreens,
the
documents right?
The Evergreens. My parents, the oligarch. Hey, listen, I'm answering. I got some of it. I was reading in the Boolean thing on August 17, 1999 in Mesquite, Nevada. I was reading from some documents from the Secret Council of 10. But also, I found out when I talked to the Evergreens, channeled by Michael Blake Reed, they had a lot of similar information as what was in the oligarchic maps. So the Evergreens talked about the Boodians. That's what I was referring to. You know, and you can go on ionabob.com and listen to those sessions that I was quoting.
Right, and I listened to them on YouTube, but, like, it's kind of ironic, though, because Anton Wilson talked about some similar experience in the 70s when he had some
He got struck by, some laser beam, just like his friend Philip K. Dick did. They had a psychic eruption. But that's
not what
I was experiencing. I wasn't talking. I'm talking to the Evergreens in a balanced, comprehensive way. I'm not reacting to a beam that hit my head. That's what happened to Philip K. Dick.
But Robert Anton Wilson said he experienced some sort of similar experience that he thought he was getting communications from the star system Sirius.
I know, and he felt the same thing as Philip K. Dick, who was his buddy. They had the same experiences in the 70s.
So you didn't
What?
You didn't have a similar situation of the Boolians?
I had some weird astral body experiences, yes, I did, but I didn't stay limited and didn't make a whole world map out of it. I knew there were more to come. But I could make a map out of what everybody was sharing. They weren't necessarily sharing my personal subjective experience. Everybody was sharing cable TV in the 70s. Well, maybe the late 70s. But they were sharing the technology environment. So you talk about that. That's the perceptual language that everybody's involved in.
So how do you prove that other extraterrestrial beings exist unless you're referring to angels and demons in religious
myth? I can't prove it yet.
Yeah, but I mean, I think.
But then Ion showed up, and I could start to prove something was out there beyond our physical.
Right, and Aleister Crowley, the occultist, he dealt into the occult and a lot of magic and rituals and
One of his top students wrote about Ion in the 80s.
Right, but I mean I'm actually talking about the original Aleister Crowley. The alien.
I actually met him. Now listen to this. You're talking to a guy who met him through my father. You'll see it in my diaries. But that's at Fontainebleau, where Gurdjieff was, and Crowley was lurking around the same area. Now, there's a TV show about Crowley right now called Strange Angel. Are you watching that?
No, I mean, I watched a movie called The Alchemical Wedding of him. And
Watch The Strange Angel. They show Strange Angels, about Jack Parsons and the beginning of the rocketry world in the United States in the late 30s. that led into World War II. And Crowley, don't know if this is based on fact, but he sent a letter from London, they show it, congratulating Jack Parsons, even though on the surface he had never met Parsons, wouldn't even know about him. But Parsons had just joined Crowley's cult in Los Angeles, and I guess Crowley found out about it and wrote him a letter, a personal letter to him, and all the other new students were jealous because he got the letter and the others didn't. But Jack would unfold and be a useful citizen and led to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is almost the same initials as Jack Parsons, JP. Jack Parsons, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, so Jack Parsons Laboratory. But he was an outsider. At least that's how he's presented in the TV show, as someone that the university authorities don't want having to do with. So he has to do all the work on the sideline and get no credit. In the late 30s, into World War II.
Was his lab blown up on purpose to get rid of him, or was it actually an accident?
I don't know that. I never investigated that. Could have been. You know what's an interesting movie? It's called Voyeur. And it's about this guy who bought a hotel way back there. That's something. And then he designed it so he could spy on all the tenants in the motel. So this famous American journalist on the level of Tom Wolfe named Gay Talese, he found out about this guy, so he followed his career for 30 years until this guy went public. And then the situation...
1970, like the movie Voyeur that came out last year.
Yes.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
No, I just heard about it.
I recommend it. And here's an idea you get from it. A little man sits around observing and watching people. You know, they're not that proactive. So they're watching and observing, and they've enjoyed this for hundreds of years, and now it's flipped on them. Now they are being watched by the android meme. So the karma of having watched.
How are they being watched?
By Echelon, by National Security Agency, our surveillance, every email thing you
like
do.
Edward Snowden and stuff.
Yeah. And so little man watched and sat on the sidelines for centuries, and he didn't know it, but a world was being created where he could not get rid of the knowledge that he was being watched.
But, man, it sounds like we're living in some sort of, like, brave new world, man.
Well, like that's been going on for most of the 20th century. We're in a better world than any horror or science fiction ever projected.
So we're living, like, in the Matrix 20 or something?
Yeah. Yeah, Matrix 20. Like, doing fine.
I mean, that sounds like, those all are like science fiction movies, but I mean, Obviously.
We live McLuhan said back in the 50s, we live entirely by science fiction. We live science fiction. That's a given and he said every possible science fiction scenario you can think of is already happening. It's
all right,
happening.
We still don't. Yeah, I mean, I guess you're probably right.
What?
Yeah, to an extent, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, where everything that could be is relatively happening already, not in the complete format, but implications of it. I mean, they have machines where they can save every email, and billions of them are communicated all the time. They can save everything. They have a record of every electronic transfer. So that's pretty impressive, eh?
Yeah, they say that we're going to be, like, recorded in history, like a digital information. Like, we're going to soon be able to download our minds like a computer file.
Well, I don't, mind is probably too ambiguous a word. We'll be able to do lots with our recorded, replayed data. Yep.
I know, but like in 15 years, like we're going to have so much memory space that we're going to be able to just download everything on a file, like on a CD disc. and you could record your whole life
history.
You won't
be doing it. You won't be doing it. The digital technology will be doing it for you.
Right, exactly. But you have to back up your mind file. That's what Ray Kurzweil says.
No, you won't have to do anything. It'll be all done for you. You'll be in an enlightened state by default. You won't rely on memory. You'll just know.
So we'll be like half biological and half machine or something, like have nanobots in our bloodstream or something.
No, don't split it. You'll be five parts with the six sneaking up on you. You'll be a chemical body, an astral body, chip body, TV body, a mystery body, and the hexavi body sneaking up on you, which be due to the RNA drops in our products.
So where does the chemtrails come into that? Like they're bombarding us with chemical.
They're perfectly natural.
Toxins,
you know, the plane movement creates that kind of exhaust and freezing. Not a problem.
That has to be toxic, though, right?
No, it doesn't have to be toxic.
I mean,
you believe somebody told you it was toxic?
I don't know. There's a lot of conspiracy theories out there, you know?
That's all there is. All information is now based and laden with suspicion. Everybody's super aware that no information tells anything completely valuable. So everybody's suspicious of information. So everybody has a jaundiced eye to their experience every day. So a narrative of that is called conspiracy theory.
Which there should be. I mean, people should question, right?
No, questioning is just mind activity. It doesn't get very far.
So you should just blindly accept your fate like a sheep?
No.
And
energetically accept your fate, not blindly or blandly. Energetically. There's nothing stopping you from jogging or doing any kind of activity. You just have to show up at work for a few hours every day.
That still doesn't stop, natural disasters from happening or
terrorism. You think death is a problem?
I think it is. Actually, we still haven't solved death, if you want to be honest. I mean,
well, I'm going to be real honest and tell you that death is not any form of an existential reality, so we don't have to solve it.
So why is there so much philosophy and religion on death?
Because books were dumped on them, and they're hypnotized by books, and they spend a lot of time reading them and discussing them. And now the electric age has evaporated all those issues.
I don't see how it evaporated. We still have religious broadcasts on television.
Well, they have all kinds of broadcasts of every meme that ever was, because no meme ends. So they're going to have more and more wealth for every former meme. But they do show pictures, as you saw one yesterday, of young university students sitting in the stacks of the library texting, wasn't reading any of the books.
Yeah, but texting is still a form of text. Even if it's in a book or a cell phone, it's still a form of text.
No, the way McLuhan defined anything humans made as a medium, Derrida defined everything that human people made as a text. So it doesn't mean a book text. It's McLuhan's medium is the message. So every artifact from that table to the airplane flying over there is a text. That's what they had to learn in college in the 80s.
Whose text is this? Is this some sort of mysterious textbook that you're referring to?
Well, where do technologies and media come from? That's the question.
Well, obviously from humans.
Ayn says it comes from them. Unrealized creations.
Human beings are the only ones that create text, so it obviously comes from humans.
Say that again?
I said human beings are the only species that create text. So obviously it comes from us. So that question is sort of redundant.
You know, it might be one that's easily answered. You have a sense of knowing that question. But Ion says, actually, you have to include the guff as part of ourselves, a non-physical, and that's where all the technologies are stored as unrealized creations. That's the sense that they're in the human, and whatever that last idea was you said.
The texts are just recordings on paper or stone or
television. Text is this phone system we're using. That's how the postmodernists define text. They didn't like McLuhan because he was a Catholic, so they said, okay, let's take a term that applies to everything humans make, and we'll use that instead of the word medium. So they came up with the word text. And you keep thinking of it as a book text. It's not how they use it.
Yeah, you're talking text messaging and emails.
No. When you walk down the street and you're watching these firemen do something with a burning house, that's text. That's the landscape.
You're talking about like textile.
No, I'm talking about anything that humans engage is called text in postmodernism.
Like a context.
No, you've got to deal with the first fact. Anything invented is text.
Hey, so you know you have a context. Is there such thing as a protext?
Protext. Yes, I think that's a facial cream. All right. You try to be snarky. We can play your game, Mr. Cobalt.
It wasn't snarky.
I know.
Sounds
yeah, you weren't, but I interpreted it that way.
Well, I've never actually really thought about it until right now. But, yeah, I guess. Protext. Yeah, it's good for your skin. All right. So context is around you, and protext is your skin. That
right. It's P-R-O-T-E-X, I think.
Yeah, protext.
P-R-O-T-E-X. That's the medicinal cream or something, I'm pretty sure. But you know, you want to add the T and, yeah, have a protext.
I'm just wondering if that's already a thing that somebody has talked about or in the philosophical, phenomenological. Because phenomenology is kind of all about context and perception of context and interaction with context. It's the grounds. So the protext would be the figure. Or would it? Has anybody covered that before? I don't know. That's what I was asking. Seems kind of like a basic thing for an academic to acknowledge and define.
Yeah. Say that sentence again.
Well, context. Right? You've got pros and you've got cons. And if we're all obsessed with the context, that is the negative of the pro-text.
That's right. Ion is pro-text. Pro-reactive, pro-creative.
Yeah.
All the rest of us are mere visitors. They're just stuck in context.
Yeah, all right. Cool.
That's who's this? Sense. What's your name?
Me? Rick.
I thought you were Fred, but you're not.
Reichenstein. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was the guy from Seattle talking. Though I was a bit confused. No. Yeah, there it is. There's Seattle. What are you mumbling?
Down here.
What's your name?
What, the guy from Seattle?
Yeah.
Well, we're out of the motherfucking Sun War, Bob.
You spoke too fast. Did you say ORA?
Yeah.
All right. You were on Saturday. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Bramley and Rich. Where do you go with that, Rich?
I think it's cool. I mean, like, everybody's obsessed with context. Let's talk about protext. I think that's, like, an awesome, could you say meme to expand upon?
That's what Ion's all about, protext.
Right, cool. So I will adopt that nomenclature as well. Cool.
Right. Yeah, spell it, I guess, P-R-O-T-E-X-T to bounce off context.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a progressive.
Anybody else want to say anything? We'll go back to you, Rich, if no one says anything. See, they're lazy. They'd rather just listen to you talk.
Well, you know. Are you sure, guys? I don't know. What do you think about protest? Somebody's got to have a thought on that.
Yeah, Bramley and the other guy. Who's the other guy? Bramley and Van. Van hasn't said anything. Okay, back to you, Rich. Don't seem to want to say anything.
Well, that's cool. I guess that, like, the concept leaves them speechless. It must mean it's good.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. The protest is down.
Now, if Clinton was here, Clinton be saying a lot. And Clinton, he recorded last week's conversation after we stopped recording on Bill's system. And it's got 2.5 hours there. It's pretty interesting, our talk after the recording last week.
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm just killing some roaches and shit.
All right, well, focus on what Rich is saying.
Yeah, I was listening. Pro and cons, context, protects. Obviously, these are just terms, you know, like we're basically just talking about the outlook on how
obvious again. You're talking. You go obviously. You start something always with the word obviously.
Well, I mean, I okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to elaborate on same terms. But I was just saying basically what I'm trying to explain is that we tend to repeat ourselves. Repeatedly, like
consciousness. We repeat ourselves like consciousness does.
Yeah, it's self-referential.
Yeah. That's true.
It's hard to...
You wouldn't say that to your lover, self-referential. What would you say to your lover?
Well, obviously, I mean, I'll be talking other terms, not referring to myself.
Yes, you would not be using the latest sociological jargon.
Correct.
Unless she's a hardcore sapiosexual, in which case, you know, you've got to throw some words at her and she'll fall in your arms. It works sometimes.
I try not to stay in my head too much.
Well, where do you go if you're not in your head?
I'm usually thinking about outer space or something.
Yeah, that's other parts of your head, inside your cranial imagery.
No, space is outside of my head, regardless if my head's here or not.
Ah, that's what you don't recognize. You have literate eyes, so you separate what your eye sees from reality. So you make a statement like you just did.
That's a mystical statement. That's not an astrophysical or astronomical statement. That's a metaphysical statement. Space exists beyond me, regardless if I'm mindful or not. metaphysics was thought in time and space. Like Immanuel Kant, all the metaphysicians. I mean, before
we're stuck
physics.
In the effect of the book. They were all stuck in the concept of time and the effect of the book.
I guess. I mean, but that's still relevant today.
No guessing.
It's a very
that's why they came
guess.
Up with these concepts as you're talking about.
Define meta.
Metaphysics is before physics.
No. Define just meta. The prefix meta.
Like, what do you mean?
Googler.
All right, you want me to Google meta?
Yeah.
All right. Meta definition. Meta, referring to itself or to the conventions of its genera, is self-referential.
Yeah. What's
self-referential.
What's the metaphor? Bob should know this by heart.
Meta, after, along with, beyond.
Yeah.
Greg? Robert, what is the metaphor?
You're addressing me when you say Robert?
Yes.
You want a metaphor?
What is a metaphor? What is it for?
Metaphor means to cross a bridge.
No, it means because a man's grasp or a man's reach must exceed his grasp. Come on, that's McLuhan.
McLuhan?
That's McLuhan, yeah. It's in the whatever that book was, the one with all the poems in it.
McLuhan, LaRouche. I just posted LaRouche explaining metaphor a week and a half ago.
No, synchronicity.
Did you watch it?
I did not. But I've asked you that question about 13 times.
Any other comments?
So you think metaphysics was some amateur literature people? I mean, these people were...
No, it wasn't
like,
immature. It was a new environment, new novelty. Began in Greece and Jewish culture and expanded into the wonderful libraries we have today.
Right, and that's how we have physics today.
Well, physicists try to fit it back into alphabet sources, but that's their problem. Because it's not going to work, according to Ion. The I must be destroyed. The I must be brought back into the corral.
The acoustic environment.
Tactile environment. Not acoustic. McLuhan called it odd owl tactile.
What's the difference between the acoustic environment and the tactile environment?
The acoustic is sensory,
uh-huh.
And tactility is not a sense. It's the interplay of the senses, the interplay.
I thought tactile was the interplay of the senses.
Yeah, that's tactile. That's tactile. That's odd owl tactile. That's what you asked about.
So they're the same?
What? What's
well, if
they?
You're calling it odd owl tactile, does that mean you're combining them?
Yes, but it has the odd owl, it has a sensory part. It's not pure tactility.
Okay.